The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
So everybody that's here, as usual, appreciate those that keep coming back. This will be a really interesting conversation. I will tell you that now that I've been doing these spaces for as long as I have been, I've now, I think, seen it all and all in the Twitter space world. In that first, I had interviewed a little green chicken in Doomburg, and now I'm interviewing an actual deer with Deer Point Macro, which we'll talk about. My name is Michael Guyon, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour here is Deer Point Macro. Now, Deer Point, I know you want to keep a degree of anonymity, just like Doomburg in that sense. But to the extent that you're comfortable, just talk about a little bit about who you are, your background, why are you qualified to talk about markets, and what is it you're trying to do with your research?
Yes, thank you so much, first of all, for having me on, Michael. So for me, I guess, educationally, I studied economics. I went into the institutional side. Actually, currently, right now, I work with an institution in Canada, helping go about doing mutual fund analysis. So going through and looking at things that we would end up compiling and using as investments for the mutual funds. The current institution I do work with is a complete net issuer. So they do everything in-house. So that's kind of where I've been working now. As for the research, you know, long-term, I think the goal really is to end up kind of going into the boutique side and running kind of my own research shop, but not there yet. So until then, it's just kind of been an open way to kind of keep track of my work, what I'm thinking, where I think markets are going, what I think we're going to see in terms of like economic regimes and those kinds of things.
So I've been using this line more often that amateurs look to the right of the equal sign and pros look to the left. And in the institutional world, the looking to the left is looking at process. I want you for the audience just to talk a little bit about how you go about analyzing investment strategies from an institutional perspective, because I think there's a very different mindset when it comes to true longer-term investing versus the stuff that we see on FinTwit.
Yeah, so when we're looking at the companies, and a lot of times we also do a lot of fixed income stuff, I would say that the valuations are actually just down to that, doing actual in the weeds, reading through 10Ks, very boring stuff that I guess is not very popular on FinTwit, running discounted cash flow models, seeing, you know, where the valuation of these companies are, looking at, you know, indebtedness, which is obviously a big kind of overhang, especially now with rising interest rates, whether or not we believe that that will be something that's sustained or not, is nevertheless putting, you know, massive burden on some of these companies. And when you're looking at actually investing in them in the long term under current conditions, having to change, you know, kind of things that are going on, at least on the monetary regime with rising, you know, changes in discount rates, which have now, for let's say if you're looking at hyper growth, has made like a complete shift in terms of, you know, price to free cash flow. So that's really kind of what we've been doing, at least on the institutional side, and looking long term is actually getting in the weeds and looking at valuations and kind of going back to more or less good old value investing, at least what I do on a day-to-day basis. And then on myself, in terms of actual research, I take everything kind of more, instead of a bottoms up approach, I take more of a top down. So completely kind of looking at the macro first and then trying to use that as a way to gauge what I think is going to happen into the future.
Okay, so let's get into the top down here because, I obviously been aware of you and I know you've attended several of my own spaces. I've listened to some of yours, but I never actually read through your research. And I spent a little time before this conversation looking at your Substack, which I encourage everybody, by the way, to sign up to. If you just click on Your Point's profile, click on that link. You know, it's free, but it's a really interesting stuff here. And you have a piece that basically makes an argument that the bigger concern is not really inflation, but rather deflation. Now, to set the stage, I tend to be, in my own subjective thinking, more of a deflationist longer term, which is not a very popular opinion until you realize how much debt we have, right? Then suddenly it becomes popular because suddenly there's a realization that you can't really pay off this debt with any amount of inflated dollars, you know, longer term. Talk about this dynamic of what I've myself have argued is inflation short term versus deflation long term.
Yeah, I think once we start to look at short-term inflation, which is kind of where everybody has been, obviously, you know, we've seen inflation absolutely ripping. Kind of one way I think that even if you start to look at market expectations of inflation is to kind of start to look at like five-year forward inflation break-evens. And if you start to look at those things, those are relatively well anchored. And so On that front, without diving kind of as a way to start, the market's expectations of inflation are relatively well anchored around that 2% target. I think right now they're trading at like 208 basis points or something like that. So, you know, 8 basis points above what the Fed's normal kind of natural rate of inflation would be. Looking more long term, kind of where we start to get into things is starting to talk about, and within that piece that you're talking about is kind of looking at, you know, the marginal revenue product of debt. And anybody who's familiar with Lacey Hunt's work or, you know, kind of taken economics courses is probably familiar kind of with this idea of the marginal revenue product of debt. And that's how much additional GDP we can generate per dollar of debt. And what we see is now it takes about $2.50 of debt to produce only $1 of GDP. That's all-time high. And so, you know, the further that you go out is we start to look at where we've kind of long surpassed this phase where additional increases in debt will lead to increases in productivity. And in economics, that's called the law of diminishing returns. It kind of moves in a parabola where as you start to take on debt, there's a massive benefit to that debt. Then you kind of hit this peak point where taking on debt doesn't really lead to any benefit. And then finally, the actual decrease where taking on additional debt actually is a net negative. And so, you know, we have kind of entered into this condition in which we have taken on debt to more or less subsidize consumption. And, you know, the problem with this is that debt needs to generate income for the repayment of principal for it to actually be more or less worthwhile. Or if it's not being utilized that way, then you're just, you know, deferring, you know, future cash for future debt payments. And so I think that this is kind of where you start to get into this debt is going to end up being deflationary kind of idea, especially in the long term, because obviously all we're going to be able to do is get more and more indebted to kind of try to dig our way out of this.
Yeah. And I've always made this point that there's kind of three reasons why you can make a case that you can't really escape deflation long term, not just the debt aspect, but I've argued that, you know, obviously technology is disinflationary, deflationary. The wealth gap is enormously disinflationary, deflationary, because Zuckerberg doesn't need two planes to get to where he needs to go. So it craters the velocity of money as you have concentration of wealth around a small percentage of the population. Then, of course, demographics. Everyone seemingly forgot that we still have baby boomers that hold the vast majority of assets, retiring and divesting, right? So none of those dynamics changed with COVID. I'd argue actually it accelerated.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly, especially I know that a lot of people have started to compare this to the 1970s. And that's again, where I think we start to get into a disinflationary, deflationary regime. If you look at the 1970s, you had a massive inflow of people into the workforce. I think at that time as well, you had the largest influx of women into the workforce. So even though real wages at that time were negative, the marginal propensity to consume was still elevated because you just had so many people who now have a wage, whether or not that wage is negatively real, and they're still going to go out and consume because now they have more dollars in their pocket than they did when they weren't working. We have much different demographics today where we have an aging workforce, we have aging demographics, and that is also something that I think adds to this deflationary regime. And something else that I've kind of touched on is, you know, I find it weird where people start to kind of say, oh, you know, this whole bout of inflation is monetary. But for people to really believe that we're going to have inflation long term, what they would have to essentially be betting on is that economic growth will surpass the growth of debt. I personally think that that is highly improbable. And on that same article that you referenced on is deflation on the horizon, I actually post a graph between, you know, federal debt, the total public debt as a percentage of GDP against the velocity of money, which is inverted. And obviously they have a complete inverse correlation. So, you know, we're going to continue to see a suppression of the velocity of money, unless, like I said, you believe somehow we get crazy amounts of economic growth that can then go and actually surpass the growth of debt.
So that would imply that, as much as everyone often says, the bond market is more right than the stock market, that would imply that the bond market's move the first 6 months of the year may actually be wrong, meaning that with the long end selling off as aggressively as it has and yields spiking from a very long duration perspective, that may be an enormous overshoot, which could be actually quite bullish for long duration treasuries as the disinflation deflation play.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. And actually something that I've actually liked in general, if you believe that we'll move into a disinflationary regime, or you believe that the Fed will get inflation under control, is obviously also long dated treasuries, zero coupons specifically.
Right. And I always mention treasuries because they're all risk on, risk off. They all have the same commonality, which is treasuries are the defensive risk off play, because risk off coincides with deflationary pulses where stocks go down and treasuries benefit. You know, I've said many times this year has been hell because treasuries did not act the way they historically do in high volatility pulses. But if that longer term dynamic of disinflation deflation is there, that probably means this inverse correlation kicks back in when you see these high volatility bounce in equities, which is actually a good thing for diversification, I would argue.
No, I would 100% agree with that. And I think that it's, and that's something that's very odd that you also see on FinTwit a lot, is I think that there's a lot to focus on equity markets relative to the bond market. And I actually think the bond market and rates markets in general are kind of the best, let's say, forecaster in terms of where we should actually be expecting, you know, future like kind of expectations to be. And I think that, you know, I had a conversation or a space a couple of days ago actually with Nancy Davis, where we were kind of saying that there's been this massive dislocation between like what the bond market is saying is happening or will happen, and, you know, the happy-go-luckiness that we've seen in the equity markets.
Let's get some of the audience in here.
In terms of China, I think actually what we will start to see, and I this might also be a bit of a contrarian opinion, but I think that kind of the role, I don't want to say if China is going to be decreased, but I think what we're going to start to see is just because of how inelastic supply chains became over the course of the pandemic, I think what we're going to start to see is a lot of onshoring. The problem with maybe, you know, relying too heavily on China is, I think that this has actually created a lot of conditions in which, you know, our supply chain has been too reliant on globalization, which I think under these kind of exogenous factors that we're seeing has created more or less conditions in which, you know, there's kind of no way to have any sort of backstop. And so I think that once you start to kind of look at what like Congress is doing without like getting too political, I think that it's becoming a realization of a lot of countries, Europe, United States, that they have to do more things internally than relying on other countries to more or less make sure that they are well taken care of with Europe, whether it be energy, with United States, whether it be China for semiconductors or Taiwan for semiconductors and manufacturing. So I'm not sure in the long run how important of a role China will play. But I think that the role in terms of globalization will start to diminish to some degree.
Just to be devil's advocate on that, on this kind of onshoring and deglobalization, I wonder if there's really a serious incentive by corporate leaders to initiate that move en masse, right? Because the reason why a lot of these companies are so cash rich is because of the labor arbitrage, really, from going overseas. And if consumers are simply getting used to furniture coming 6 months later from when they order it, they still make more money with, you know, a broken supply chain than with just in time or just in case onshoring. So margins will get squeezed at that point. So I don't know. I don't disagree with the narrative that you're going to have this kind of broader deglobalization shift, but I just wonder how fast that would happen when you have incentives in place to just keep
the existing system in place because it enriches those who put it in place to begin with.
No, that's a good point. And that's kind of where I am trying to figure out how much will we actually end up having to onshore. But I think that it's going to become more kind of important, especially now if you start to even look at the geopolitical issues, right? Like, you know, America and Saudi Arabia, those relationships are diminishing, right? Or America and China, those relationships now with everything going on with Taiwan are going to start to diminish. So I think that as this kind of heightened levels of geopolitical like uncertainty start to rip throughout the world, I'm not sure even if you were a corporation at one point, you have to say, okay, this is just like, it's almost like being heavily invested in emerging markets when you never know what's going to happen on like a geopolitical front from day to day. And I think that that's going to be something that either we're going to have a change in I think how nations end up viewing each other and how nations are kind of becoming more or less kind of hostile towards one another. This isn't like, you know, the happy-go-lucky nations where everybody was just kind of willing to you know, play ball and get along. I think that that has changed quite drastically over the past 2 years.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit to this supply chain aspect. So I shared at the top of the Nest the tweet you put out about global supply chain pressure index leading the price pressure index, and that you're starting to see obviously some of these supply chain disruptions or inflationary forces abating at least a bit. Now, I do wonder, and I want to hear your thoughts on this, dear point, if the Fed is miscalculating all of their hawkishness, because I don't believe they've really pivoted. I mean, words are very different than action. But I do wonder if you have a situation where there's a timing mismatch. Everyone's assuming that inflation persists, remains very high, and that you will not see an inflation crash. But if you happen to have supply chain disruptions after such a long period of time really ease at the same time as the lagged effect of Fed policy tightening kicks in, you could get a sort of a dual situation where suddenly prices are reverting back to normal naturally, but then demand is cratering at the exact same time, which means a real deflation scare could take place.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree with that. Because what you're going to have is you're going to have, I think, you know, supply chains are going to start to shift back, you know, towards the right, which means that they're kind of the price level is coming down and they're becoming less inelastic. And then at the same time, if you're tightening demand or, you know, you're trying to go about policy, especially with what the Fed's doing with rate hikes, I think trying to get, you know, wealth effects to change in the sense where people start to feel more poor, which they haven't because, you know, equity markets are, you know, back at what, 41, 4200. They really need to create conditions in which, you know, that demand starts to shift back to the left. So I think that if you do kind of get this condition where supply chain pressures start to ease, which is what we're starting to see, and you start to see price pressure start to come down extremely quickly, but then at the same time, you're getting massive demand destruction. I don't think most people are really realizing how fast that we can kind of make this shift from the high inflation back to disinflation or deflation. And again, something that I've also talked about is people, you know, are like, oh, well, the 70s. And that's something that you keep hearing. But I don't think that it can be kind of stressed enough that obviously the kind of the marginal propensity of consumption today is much different than it is back in the 70s. And, you know, we're seeing consumers try to continue consumption patterns, but they're doing that on the back of, let's say, toxic forms of borrowing, like credit cards. Credit card revolving credit is increasing at the same time while you're having a drawdown in personal savings. And so, like, I remember on one of my Substacks, I think it might have been the deflationary one, actually. But what I was looking at is from April of last year to April of this year, you had 1.6 trillion in consumer spending. 1.5 trillion of that came from a drawdown in consumer savings. The other 120 billion came from increases in credit card debt. So you start to look at those things and you say, well, you know, under conditions in which, you know, you get massive demand destruction, it's not going to take a whole lot for us to get there because the consumer's already starting to get kind of tapped.
Right. And then you add on top of that, you know, potential housing recession, which we'll talk about. Then you're talking about a really nasty storm that could be coming. But let's get two of the audience members in here.
That kind of gets into the conversation of your kind of economic theory, right? Like if you're kind of more, let's say, in the side of a monetarist, monetarism would state like as long as like a country prints its own currency, it can't theoretically default, right? So yeah, and that's kind of the position I take. So no, I don't think that's much different than emerging markets. I think that you could definitely see emerging market defaults, but let's say the ECB, the United States, Bank of Japan for that matter, I don't think that the probability of them defaulting would actually ever take place. It would essentially just come in and yeah, theoretically, I guess you could say print money. Yeah.
And I will say also this, I mean, this is why it's not say it's the Japan debt trap because that's the sample size of one, but the reality is the whole world is in this scenario. When the moment everyone went fiat, the moment you destroyed discipline with any government on spending is the moment you wrote your fate, right? In terms of the end game. The end game, I think, being, you know, exactly to that point that you can't simply let the free market do what it needs to do, so you've got to subsidize it by printing, you know, currency to pay off all these unfunded liabilities because there's no way otherwise.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the healthcare side. The aerospace side, honestly, I don't know too much about in terms of how much like a Lockheed Martin or Raytheon is using outside, like let's say manufacturing or, you know, to use as inputs for, you know, the development of aerospace, you know, and defense products. That sector I'm not as familiar with, so I'd have to do more research in that before I could answer on it. If we could do something with semiconductors, obviously that could help tremendously across different kinds of sectors. Obviously, the automotive sector had a lot of issues with chip shortages, minus Tesla, who actually went and reprocessed kind of their chips, but nobody else wanted to do that. Nobody else wanted to take on that kind of liability. But I think that bringing semiconductors backside could just help a tremendous range of sectors, not just automotive, but, you know, so things like that, I think, would be very beneficial. And then trying to find a way, maybe more or less, this might not be as much actually an industry, but making sure that like intellectual property, keeping intellectual property within the United States instead of kind of shipping that abroad, I also think would kind of benefit us from an onshoring standpoint.
We've been DMing back and forth. You had mentioned that you wanted to talk about the dollar shortage, which sounds like a strange concept because you wouldn't think if you have inflation that you'd have a dollar shortage, but obviously the movement in currency, I think, tells you there's an element of that. Talk about this dynamic of a dollar shortage. First of all, what does that even mean in practice? And how do you square that with all the supposed liquidity which the Fed had put into the system?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what metric you want to use. But there's, I would say, probably two broad ways, at least that I measure dollar shortage. One being looking at the euro dollars, and you can kind of like, let's say, look at the euro dollar futures curve. And if you're seeing like massive inversion within the euro dollar futures curve, I think that that is a sign of a liquidity event brewing, that liquidity event being the inability of banks to actually have enough dollar liabilities to go about on a day-to-day basis in terms of dealing with their funding needs. And then the second issue, or the second kind of thing that I look at, is the cross-currency basis swap, which more or less is kind of a way to measure dollar shortages and the inability for banks to access the wholesale dollar funding market. You also do have within that negative basis kind of a risk that's associated to, let's say, perceived counterparty risk. But those are kind of the two ways that I go about measuring dollar shortages. And what you're starting to see is that there has actually been this inability for banks to access the wholesale dollar funding market if you're looking at cross-currency basis swaps. And I know that I have that somewhere on my page. I could host it for, like, if you're looking at Japan or you're looking at Europe or if you're looking at even Canada. And so what that is kind of telling you is that there is broadly a lack of dollars. And as long as that persists, that basis is going to continue to get more negative, and that's going to put more strain on the financial system. And then probably my final point to that is if you start to look at just, you know, failures to deliver, which is done by the New York Fed for the primary dealers, there's also a shortage of treasury collateral. And so if you start to look at what's happening with the primary dealers, what you're seeing is like there's been this persistent increase in failures to deliver on a week over week basis. I think a week ago when I was looking at it, it was up 22% on a week over week basis. So obviously that is also another indication that there's not enough collateral in the form of treasury securities within the global financial system. And so,
which by the way, that's a bizarre concept for most people to intellectualize, because that implies that you actually have to have a hell of a lot more treasuries, a hell of a lot more debt.
100%. And, you know, QE is kind of a function of that, right? Because that's essentially removing, you know, treasuries from the market. And, you know, theoretically, QT would allow those to be rehypothecated. But still, broadly speaking, I don't even know if you ran off everything that the Fed had on its balance sheet, it would be enough to kind of ease the treasury shortfall that we have within the global financial system. And so I think that if you start to actually look at these kinds of things, you know, we took on upon ourselves the kind of, as a reserve currency, the ability to actually, or the responsibility to make sure that people are provided, you know, dollar liquidity. And so far, there's been a massive shortage of dollar liquidity. And so, you know, I think that this is another thing that where you're going to see the actual value of the dollar continue to be relatively strong, kind of like Bryn Johnson talks about.
Yeah, and I've argued too that the dollar strength almost looks like it's foretelling some kind of sovereign debt crisis is incoming, because usually a sovereign debt crisis first manifests in currency volatility. The thing is, you've got currency volatility everywhere, which is a whole other thing to play out. Let me reset the room for everybody that's here. Please make sure you follow Dear Point Macro, subscribe to his Substack as well. You can tell very thoughtful and very analytical in the way he approaches things. My name is Michael Gayad, publisher of Lead Lag Report.
Yeah, I think that if we deduce out COVID, the American consumer is pretty healthy. Sorry. I was getting a phone call there.
That's the one thing I hate about spaces, by the way. It's just suddenly somebody calls you, you just mute it out and you don't realize it. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you deduce out what happened with COVID, the American consumer is pretty healthy. And what I mean by that is if you look at actual household expenditures on things like food, again, deducing out COVID because that's an exogenous factor, households within the United States spend about 6 or 7% as a percentage of income on food. Gas, oil and gas, again, deducing out this kind of exogenous factor that we've had, is about 6%. You look at like the rest of the world, even Canada, like Canadians spend a lot higher percentage of their income on food. It's about 10 or 12%. And then you have higher debt servicing costs. Americans have relatively low debt servicing costs compared to their G7 counterparts. I think Italy has the lowest, maybe followed by Japan and then the States, Canada having the highest debt service costs. Our debt service ratios within the G7. So I think that if you start to look at those things, the actual ability of the American consumer to be able to afford American-made products, I think it's there, right? And obviously, the price increases, you would have price increases, but I think it comes back to how efficiently we could actually end up making things. If there was a way to, if we had been, like, let's say, investing in productive capacity relative to and subsidizing consumption, you know, like, if the government has to do some fiscal injection, why not do it into like industry instead of doing it into, you know, consumers who are just going to not buy anything that's going to produce any kind of long run economic growth, right? They're not buying plants and equipment. They're not buying machinery. They're not investing in anything that's like a real economic asset. Instead, they're, you know, YOLOing into AMC and meme stocks, right? So, you know, it's not a like, let's say, a productive use of fiscal spending. And I think that if we found a way to actually bring back a productive use of fiscal spending in terms of growing the manufacturing base, I think a lot of that cost arb could actually be eliminated. We would have higher wage costs, I mean, because of minimum wage laws. And if I had things my way, I would say we should abolish minimum wages. Hot take. I'm probably going to get crucified for that. But, you know, I'm just saying that broadly speaking, if we actually went into this environment, I think that we could actually get costs down to a relative basis where it wouldn't be that much more extreme than what we've been paying, you know, for overseas goods.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that productive and fiscal spending are mutually exclusive. So I don't know if you get the two together on that, but let's go to a fourth question.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Gayad here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
For the monetary front, I think what we have to look at is if we look at the monetary front, I don't actually believe, and this is probably going to be another hot take, that money printing in and of itself is actually like inflationary. And that's just because when Milton Friedman wrote his quantity theory of money, he was making the assumption there that the velocity of money was constant. And then if you read Keynes's general theory of employment, Keynes actually said that velocity isn't always constant. So Keynes actually might have had a little bit more insight there than Milton Friedman, who I do have a lot of respect for. But if you start to look at the decrease in the velocity of money, even if we're printing money, but that money is, let's say, not finding its way into the actual real economy, then I don't see it as an issue in the sense of us having, let's say, higher or longer term inflation. The reason that we would have to, let's say, take on additional amounts of debt is to be able to actually end up funding, you know, additional GDP growth, which is kind of where you start to get into that law of diminishing returns. But I don't think necessarily that's inflationary. I think broadly longer term, it's deflationary. As for the onshoring, yes, the onshoring could cause minor amounts of inflation in certain sectors. However, like in the beginning of the conversation, I don't believe that everything's going to be brought back and onshored, but I do think that we're going to start to see some shifts away from massive globalization just as countries start to become a little bit more skeptical of one another. But again, broadly speaking, I still would say additional money printing, and I know that that's also a hot take, is not going to lead to higher rates of inflation. Why we had inflation this, you know, over the past 2 years was we had the aggregate supply curve become completely inelastic because everything was closed down. And at the same time, you had this massive injection of fiscal injection, which then caused the marginal propensity of consumption to increase. So people wanted to consume more, but due to just-in-time manufacturing, inventories weren't there. So obviously, you know, it just, if you were thinking of simple supply and demand kind of dynamics, the aggregate supply curve would shift to the left, the aggregate demand curve would shift to the right, and then we just have a higher overall price level. But I would say that this was more of a supply side, maybe recession, so than over the past 2 years, than actually a monetary inflationary environment.
Right, and I think the idea here is that in that end game, the collapse in the velocity of money that would cause would be more than enough to offset the amount of new dollars that are printed, right? I think this is what people are, and I agree with your point on this argument. People forget that inflation is not just a function of money, but money movement. So if you end up in the eyes of an economy's constituents, making everybody believe that interest rates will stay low forever and that the government's going to keep on, by the government, I mean the Fed, going to keep on subsidizing everything, well, there's never any urgency to actually borrow more to create more transactions, and all that becomes a disinflationary force. You know, I think it mechanically in terms of the way that works. I don't know if that sounds like an accurate way of describing it, dear point, but that I think is sort of the real way to think about it.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, it's not going to be something that's solved overnight. Then obviously, like you said, you have the whole bureaucracy issue. But I think that's why we're starting to see all of this kind of, and again, without getting too political, all of this push for kind of these investment products or these investment bills within the United States, right? I think that this is kind of a way of us coming to the realization that the way we have been doing things so far, globalization is great, but you know, it has its issues, and especially when we start to see geopolitical tensions, people, the inability of nations to get along. Obviously, that's going to all lead to degradation within the actual ability of the supply chain to actually ever bounce back. Because if we end up having an issue with China, you know, China can put all sorts of sanctions and tariffs. And I'm not saying that this is something that they would do, but on the United States, right? And, you know, there's all sorts of political and economic games that they could end up playing, with not getting too conspiratorial, but that they could actually end up, you know, putting a lot of stress still on the aggregate supply side of that equation, right? Especially now, I mean, with I think Taiwan being kind of the biggest variable in terms of maybe our future dealings with China not being as friendly as they have been in the past.
But by the way, that aspect of that this is going to take time is really an important thing, which nobody seems to want to think through when they just kind of regurgitate these lines. Oh, it's deglobalization. Oh, the pendulum swings, you know, back into onshoring. Not only is it going to take time, but it assumes that there's an attention span for this. I mean, by the time a year or two from now that you could argue things maybe really accelerate on the onshoring front, the supply chain disruptions may be gone and suddenly the world looks like it's back to normal. It's not impossible, right? And just like everyone in the Eurozone forgot about all the things they wanted to do to save the euro, you know, a year or two later, it was a distant memory, right? So that's the thing about the future and narratives. The future often ends up writing its own narrative different from what the crowd says, I think, which is just an important point.
High debt to GDP and VIX. I'm not sure how, you know, debt would relate to VIX being low. What I could say about why I think that VIX has been low, it's kind of a function of, I think volatility in and of itself has flown, like you've seen outflows out of VIX, right? And I think that the volatility that would be within the equity market has found its way into the bond market, the swaptions market. If you look at like swaptions vol, currency vol, commodity vol, I think that that's where you're starting to see all of this volatility kind of peak its head. And so equity volatility has kind of more or less just seen these massive outflows. For me, this is probably the largest variable of why I don't think that the VIX has been crazy. Debt to GDP, for me, again, I guess it depends on your economic theory. For me, I say that it's a non-issue. And again, as a reserve currency, we're always going to have to be a debtor nation. We will always have to run a deficit. That's one way that we get dollars into an economy. So, you know, like those kinds of issues, again, I don't think debt to GDP for the United States is much of an issue. You know, look at Japan. That would kind of, and again, like Michael said earlier, it's a sample size one, but I still think that it's a pretty good sample size. Or even if you look north of the border, not as much on the governmental front, but on the household front, Canada, and on the corporate front, Canada as well, is highly indebted. And we've seen this ability of debt to kind of just continue to tick higher and really no broad repercussions for more debt. And I would just say that that's a function of what we have in terms of monetarism, where I think the debt is kind of a non-issue, especially on the government side.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Although I will say, just for argument's sake, that maybe you can draw some kind of a link to debt to GDP over time and average peaks in the VIX in volatility, right? Because you can make a case that the higher debt is, the larger the debt load is, the more vulnerability there is to these, you know, disinflation, deflation scares that cause these margin calls, which means that you end up having these kind of much more aggressive in magnitude declines and spikes in volatility than not, because there's not much room, right, for collateral, right? The more debt you have in any system, I would think, you know, maybe it's hard to maybe test intuitively, but it makes sense to me that the peaks in volatility would be rising as debt itself rises. More of a thought experiment.
For ISM services, I do think that we could start to see services begin to tick down. And I think that this will start to happen, again, as we start to see the consumers start to get more pinched. Usually, I look at ISM manufacturing more so than services. But I just know that if you start to look at like a lot of things that are happening, even if you just look at like retail sales or wholesale sales, which is a bit different than looking at services, what you're starting to see is very similar kind of developments, in the sense that you're having inventories, you're having sort of new orders as, you know, inventories start to build, right? Because obviously as people are holding more inventory, they're not going to go out and they're not going to be placing new orders. I actually think inventory builds, again, are something that's going to be part of the disinflationary, deflationary regime, just because that will cause margins to get compressed as, you know, those corporations are trying to get that off their, that inventory sold. And a lot of these things, especially services, more so than goods, the elasticity of demand is elastic, more so than some of the things in the manufacturing sector, where you have inelasticity of demand. So there's not a lot of substitutes. So I do think that as things start to change, as we start to get demand destruction, I do think that you could start to see a pull down within service.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad that Deer Point is proving that, unlike a deer, he does not get the deer in the headlights type of moment where he freezes with a question. All these questions, which are phenomenal. I appreciate all those that are coming up here. Let's go to...
I'll answer the second question first, and then I'll answer the VIX. I actually think that is a really good point. Again, I should have had all the, if I knew some of the questions that would be asked by the audience, I would have these things prepared beforehand. But I have somewhere on my page, if you want to just go in and try to search for it, and I'll see if I can find it here as well. There's always been a kind of a correlation between increases in nominal wages and capital deepening, i.e. like more investments in AI, more investments in like, let's say, technology, robotics, etc. And so while nominal wages have started to rise quickly, I do think that you are onto something there, in the sense that, you know, innovation and, you know, capital deepening or investments in capital deepening will actually start to lead to this sense where we are less reliant on labor, which will then obviously, like you said, drive down costs overall. And so this is something that I'm actually looking forward to. There was another article that I have somewhere on my page as well, where it was actually the largest increase in robotics, like actual like robotics in terms of being utilized for production use, I think in roughly the last decade. And so we're starting to see that where people are going to start to rely more on technology and AI to kind of get costs down. As for the VIX and the jobs report, I'm not sure if the jobs report would be a reason for a lower VIX. For me, like I was kind of talking about earlier, I think that it's been more due to outflows of volatility into different asset classes rather than being, let's say, concentrated within equity markets.
Well, see, I think that obviously as, you know, different people start to come into the, in emerging markets start to come more and more to play. I actually think that this could put further, I would say, downward pressure even on actual like price increases. And the reason that I believe that is I think the more that people demand things, just again, I'm thinking theoretical here, the more people demand things, the cheaper that it's going to be, just from a supply and demand dynamic. And so, you know, and this is granted that we get all of the supply chains started to work out. We find ways to lower costs more than where they're at now, and whether that be through robotics or, you know, other means. I actually think that that would be a net positive. The only kind of issue that I'm worried with about emerging markets is they get stuck in this conundrum. And what I mean by that is, if you look at emerging markets, and something that I've started to look at very closely is, if we continue to kind of have, let's say, high, you know, a high dollar, which I think will persist for a while, this is going to kind of, I don't want to say lead to retrogression within these developing economies, but it puts a lot of strain on them. And so one, you have terms of trade effects, which is where, you know, their exports are now being devalued relative to the price of imports. You also have emerging markets, because they're not the monetary authority of the ECB or the Bank of Canada, the BOJ, or the United States, they actually end up tightening monetary policy more rapidly. I think it was Argentina that did 950 basis points. And so you start to look at these kinds of factors, which then is going to raise the cost of capital. And all of those kinds of issues on the monetary front, I think, are things that kind of worry me about the ability for emerging markets to really be able to progress if the dollar stays high. And even if supply chains come down, if we still have a relatively high dollar because of a lack of shortage in collateral, or if the treasury doesn't go and do more treasury issuance, and if we kind of have all of these, you know, persistent factors, I think that it could actually really end up harming emerging markets. I'm not sure if that was kind of to your point, but that is one thing that I've been very concerned about.
Well, I'll add something real quick to that, because I think, you know, that's been a valid argument for a while, that, you know, to your point, Austin, that, you know, these emerging market consumers, as they get wealthier, they're going to be, you know, I think using your example, going from mopeds to automobiles, but there's an intermediary step in that argument, which is that they have to go from, you know, carbs to protein, right? So what ends up happening, I think, with a lot of these emerging market consumers that now have more wealth, is they want to eat better before anything else, which is maybe that's a conversation we can do with some other folks on food prices, but that makes for an interesting dynamic around how food prices would impact this discussion around other commodities. Because if food prices do stay elevated because you have the secular trend of emerging consumers wanting to eat better as they have more wealth, that could short circuit demand on other commodities, right? Just as they're getting more wealth. More of a interesting side note. But let's get two more questions and we'll wrap up here.
No problem. Just to kind of follow up on that question, maybe. In what way do you mean, like, resources? Like, are we talking market-wise? Are we talking? Yeah, I think that there are some, like, resources. I know that Milton Friedman had the Free to Choose network, and I believe that it's still around. I mean, that used to be a great network. I'm not sure about how it is today. I know that the Hoover Institute does a lot of very interesting things and has a lot of people on to kind of talk about policy. And they also have a lot of resources on their website to go over, you know, different government policies, whether it be healthcare or, you know, changes in, you know, corporate tax rates and all of those kinds of things, inflation. So that's another good kind of website. But I would say that it's just about maybe having the conversation with people, or, you know, finding a way to kind of connect with people and discuss, you know, what's going on within the economy, what's going on with on the policy front, what's going on even within your own neighborhood. But I think a lot of that is done more at the, maybe, like, let's say the micro or the communal level, then I think it should be done at the national level, right? Because all communities are going to be different and have different issues. So kind of, you know, the painting them all with the same brush wouldn't necessarily lead to, you know, equal outcomes for each community within, you know, the United States or globally.
Yeah. And I think I'll just add to that. I think, you know, the key thing, which is the hardest thing, is you have to filter out the noise and recognize that noise is created by actors who don't have the same incentives as you do. Right. Just like I always mention that financial media, when you look at their ratings, they tend to correlate to the VIX. Right? Same deal with page views on various websites, which means they always have a little incentive to create a degree of fear and misinformation and confusion, because people want to anchor onto something that is real. So what do? They start reading articles. So yeah, and that's why this is such a hard environment to operate in, because we talk about stocks, you know, being near all-time highs or not. What's at all-time highs is distractions and false information and opinions as opposed to fact, right? Which hopefully these spaces, as I try to keep doing them, at least lean more towards fact than not. But we'll have a last question here.
I guess I would answer that question with a question: and why is the stock market an indicator of, like, economic prosperity or strength within an economy? Right? Like, I don't mind, like, what, like, yeah. And if you wanted to say, well, Japan's had stagnant growth, I would say, okay, yeah, I agree with you. But I mean, would we rather have a? I guess it's kind of, you know, I'm not a policymaker, right? But it seems like we're more headed towards a period in which we're just going to have this stagnant economic growth, like Japan, where we probably just oscillate between 1% and 0%. And that's just probably going to be where most economies in the world end up. And I think that that's a function of how we've utilized debt and using debt in unproductive ways. You know, I think debt's a great thing. I think anybody who's, you know, worked in fixed income or you know, structured finance or, you know, credit understands that debt can be extremely useful. But I mean, it's got to be useful in, in the sense of the utilization of that debt. If you use it for nothing other than subsidizing consumption, then, you know, debt is pretty useless.
But what's not useless is following Dear Point on Twitter. So everybody, please make sure you do that. Sign up to his Substack. Thank you, everybody, for joining. This was a great conversation. You'll probably be seeing a whole bunch of these prior conversations as delayed podcasts on your various favorite platforms. Dear Point, really do appreciate the time here. Hopefully one day I will have you and Doomberg in a space. That way I can just name the space Animal Farm or something. So anyway, thank you everybody for joining. I do appreciate it, and we'll all be in touch. Thank you, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.